Greetings again, everyone. Well, I guess they say double your pleasure, double your fun when those who call or write in from now on for the Real Jesus book, which I have, and or Europe and America in Prophecy will double their pleasure and double their fun. You know why? Because God's people have paid for those books twice. I was able to buy from Benny Sharp. I have here the copy of the check. For $3,750, I bought 5,000 copies of the Real Jesus book and 5,000 copies of Europe and America in Prophecy. And so that's nice. Otherwise, they probably would have done nothing but just trash them or burn them. They also have about 9,000 copies, or 18,000, I beg your pardon, they got 18,000 copies of The Answer to Unanswered Prayer that they wanted 50 cents a piece for, and I just didn't have or want to spend $9,000 for those books right now. I've just given another brand new booklet to Mr. Tony Brazil to be printed. It's called Are We Saved by Grace Alone, or Are There Works Involved in Salvation? It is a complete rewrite of a booklet that I wrote many years ago. I have another one I'm just finishing up, which is called Mideast Strife, Will It Lead to Armageddon? And I think that that title will get a lot of interest as well. So we have some literature coming along. A prayer request to add to what we had told you before about Joyce Clevenger, who had had a pancreatic tumor that had been diagnosed as cancerous, and then she found out it was not cancerous, but nevertheless there is a tumor there, and she is in some pain, has an appointment with the surgeon next week. The doctor suspects that the tumor might be wrapped around a nerve, and maybe that's the problem. So she still is in pain and needs our prayers. Some very good news has been coming in as they've been tabulating the cards about those who are saying they will be at the Feast of Tabernacles. So far, we've had 381 people say they're going to be coming to Panama City Beach. 135 will be coming out to Kings Beach in Lake Tahoe, and 262 up at Branson. And that's growing every week. And there are other people calling in and saying that about a dozen people are coming with them. So I'm sure that between now and October the 5th, that there will be some significant changes in those numbers. But so far, that's 783 people who have committed to come to the Feast of Tabernacles. And I think that's really terrific. I did two television programs this week in my home studio, which we tear all the furniture apart. We take the little desk in the living room. We go in there. My sons come and put blankets up over the big window, and we put the lights up and all that. And I sit kind of halfway in front of my stone fireplace, and they make sure and not show my heads on the wall, because there are some vegetarians who would probably prefer that instead of a stuffed elk or a stuffed deer that I have maybe the stuffed root of a carrot or something on my wall. But I have had some bad letters from time to time from some people that do not eat meat, and they think that you shouldn't go around killing a deer. Of course, you ask them, do they eat chicken? They electrocute those dudes, you know. And I'm not so sure we ought to be eating those with all the blood just frozen right where it is. When you gnaw down next to the bone, it's all dark red, you know. That's because of the way they kill them. We can talk about that later. It's an ugly subject. Anyway, I think that's about it. We didn't manage to get up to Kimberling Springs, but I did hear from Dr. James Ricks via email. And apparently he and Natalie went over there, and they said, it is fabulous. So I don't know how many people are going to be going up that way from here. Let me just get a quick show of hands. If when we have the feast both at Panama City and at up there near Branson, Missouri, only just 5 miles south of Branson on Lake Table Rock, I think it is, how many of you would think of going up toward the Branson area for the feast? See your hands, please. Okay, great. Then how many of you would be going to Panama City? And quite a number who would not. How many are not going to be able to go? Not going to be able to go. Don't be hesitant or bashful. I know that because of monetary considerations and health considerations and age and distance and all of that, there are a lot of reasons why people simply cannot always attend the feast. All right, well, that's about all I had for you. If we'd like to have one more congregational hymn right quickly, well, then I'll come back to the sermon.
If you'll all rise and take your sheet, turn to the third page, which is page 44 in my book. Count your blessings. Mr. Armstrong, thank you. Whoops.
For many decades, I've been talking about the creation of a United States of Europe. The creation of the United States of Europe is very, very close. The euro, the official coinage and the paper money of the common market, as it used to be called, and United Europe, as it's called today, will be launched in January of 1999. I think all of you remember, because I've reminded you so many times, that when the Berlin Wall came down, my two sons and I went over to Berlin, and we saw what was happening there. I was very interested in it because, after all, I'd been expecting it since I was 15. Just shortly after World War II, when all of Germany's cities lay in rubble after day and night bombing campaigns, daytime by the American 8th Air Force, and nighttime by the British Air Armadas that went over there dumping mostly firebombs and incendiaries on cities like Hamburg, the major cities of Germany lay in rubble. And there were hundreds of thousands, literally millions, of civilians, men, women, and children, that were murdered during World War II by all sides who participated. The whole thing got started by a chance mistake on the part of some of Hitler's bombers that were using what was called a Nickebine system, and they were trying to bomb some of the strategic military targets, but straight over London. Once they did that, the British retaliated with Stirlings and Armstrong, Whitworth, Whitleys, and Lancasters, and bombed some of the German cities, mostly Hamburg, with a firebombing. Once that got started, Hitler shifted his target to London. So really, for the first time in modern warfare, and certainly unlike World War I, where it was mostly in the trenches out in Flanders and all over the area around France, and it was not a war that was waged against civilians. Civilian targets were not primarily being shelled. It was troops against troops. Now it began to become a war against total populations for total stakes. And even the civilian populaces were targets during warfare in World War II. That was nowhere quite so emphasized as in the American firebombing of Tokyo and the firestorm that it created, where more than 100,000 people died in one night. Actually, just a few months before the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the firebomb that was unleashed by LeMay's B-29s, the firebombing of Tokyo, killed more people than did the bomb in Hiroshima, which took about 92,000 lives. Those were civilians, men, women, and children. I remember so much seeing the cities of Europe, even when we first went there several years after the war, and seeing all the scarred buildings. We went down from Belgium into Aachen and Diekirch and devolved down into the valley and went to the Ruhr, to Essen, to Cologne, to Frankfurt. And we saw a great deal of the destruction that had been wrought during World War II. Well, all of you remember, of course, the Marshall Plan. And you remember that during the boom days of the 1950s and 60s, Germany came roaring back to become once again a very powerful nation. I've told you time and again how in Wolfsburg and Volkswagen plant, some of the people there actually broke apart their furniture and took it to the plant to be able to fuel the furnaces to keep those little automobiles rolling so they could flood the United States and Canada and other countries with the little Beetles that are just now making a comeback. And during that day, if you remember the Toyo Pet, a lot of people in this country thought that some of the imports from Japan and from Germany were funny-looking little things. They paid virtually no attention to them. But during all those years in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, we were orchestrating over and over again that the last chapter of European history has not been written, that Germany is going to reunite, that Eastern Europe will come out from behind the Iron Curtain, and that the nations that were usually a part of the old Holy Roman Empire, which included modern-day Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, especially Poland, and certainly East Germany, would become a part of a coalition of states, eventually numbering 10, fulfilling the prophecy of the 10 kings of Revelation 17, 12 to 14, who would be extant at the time of the intervention of God and the second coming of Christ. For 44 years, Germany lay divided. The city of Berlin was a divided city, like an enclave in the midst of East Germany. You had to go on only three air corridors that were permitted by the Russians, and a couple of landlines, both on rail and highway, where they would continually blockade it. You remember the famous Berlin airlift and the blockade when they clamped down any flow of traffic into Berlin very shortly after World War II. All during the Cold War, as it was called, that situation obtained. I have been to Germany many, many a time, and of course we maintained offices over there in Dusseldorf. Frank Schnee and later on some other people were there, and some of the Germans, the local German people, one of whom was a photographer who had actually been friendly with Hitler and had photographed him many times, took me around the country. I went over there and interviewed Franz Josef Strauss in his offices, brought him to this country, flew him all over the United States in a fan jet Falcon, had him entertained at both Ambassador and Big Sandy College campuses, and had him address the student body in assemblies. At that time, he was head of the Christian Socialist Union. And I went during the administration of Kurt Georg Kiesinger, who was Chancellor of Germany at that time, to Bavaria, to Munich, and interviewed Strauss down there, met him in a Bierstube where they were celebrating after that speech that he had given along with Kiesinger. I was right as close to them as I am to you and photographed them both. Why was I so fascinated about Europe? Why bother talking out of the pulpit, for pity's sake, about Berlin and about Europe and about Germany and about the Cold War and about the Soviet Union? Why don't we talk about the Lord? Praise the Lord! Why don't we talk about looking inwardly and do you love one another, brethren? Why would we want to look out at the world and pay any attention whatsoever to the headlines? People have been reminded about headline religion recently, I understand. Well, let me give you a headline. Just in. ECB president will be one of the world's most influential financiers from Brussels, May 2nd. The president of the European Central Bank, who will oversee monetary policy in the 11-country Eurozone, will be one of the most potent figures in all of international finance. His nomination has already emerged as the most contentious issue facing the European leaders gathered here, that was in Brussels, Belgium, it is the capital of Belgium, for an historic summit aimed at formally selecting members of Economic and Monetary Union and locking in euro exchange rates. Now, what has that got to do with anything? Well, when was the last time, most of you in this audience are probably not either small, medium, or large investors in the stock market. I understand that. But there are a lot of millions of Americans who every time that Alan Greenspan sneezes, they catch a cold. And all he's got to do is to make some little hint that maybe the government's about to raise interest rates, and the stock markets all over the world, not just in the United States, just go crazy, and billions of dollars are lost by private investors when suddenly stocks plummet. These men, by the raising of an eyebrow, by the chance little dropping of one little word, can actually control world economy, the global economy. And you all know that. This man is going to be more powerful than Alan Greenspan. Let me explain why. He's being called, the ECB stands for European Central Bank, supremo, will have absolute responsibility for price stability in what Europe has hailed as the world's greatest trading power. How many of you were seated in the audiences in the 1960s and 70s when I talked about the eventual emergence of Europe as the world's greatest trading power? And talked about, look at all those hands go up. And talked about trade war, and talked about the eventual economic collapse of the United States and Britain, and opined at that time that I did not think that eventually, when it became a military union as well as an economic union, that Britain would be a part of it. And right now, Britain is not, as yet. Britain is not one of the signatories to the 11-nation treaty adopting the euro, dragging her feet, called the sick man of Europe. A flagging economy. But guess who is a signator? And some of you will remember this as well. And remember who we think some of these people are in biblical prophecy. Ireland is a signator. And Ireland will be using the euro, where the British will stick to the pound. It will be the president, along with his vice president and four fellow council members, who will set interest rates across the euro bloc in his drive to maintain a strong euro. Now, the euro will be in competition with what? The dollar. And with the yen. The three leading currencies in the world will now be the euro, the dollar, and the yen. And they will be in competition with each other. I won't read all of this.
But let me just read a part of it. Greenspan, talking about Alan Greenspan, is closely scrutinized by all the markets, every word that he utters. With a single remark, he can and does move global stock and currency markets as the world's dominant financier uses his unofficial power to influence economic activity in the United States and abroad. Financiers know that the power of a central banker whose remit covers countries with a slice of world income equal to about 18% of the gross domestic product of the world, of the entirety of the world, that that's as much psychological as it is monetary. He will also control the gold and foreign exchange reserves of the bank. Fears that the ECB, again, the central bank of Europe, European Central Bank, will hold only minimal gold reserves has caused gold prices to slump to a nearly 10-year low in recent months. So it's already having its impact, isn't it? Those fears have caused gold prices to go down to about a 10-year low. The man's name is Wim Dusenberg, head of the European Monetary Institute, and he has won warm praise from central bankers, and just yesterday he actually agreed to serve for the first 8-year term. 8 years. He will oversee the launch of the euro currency in January 1999 and the introduction of euro notes and coins in 2002. Here is a shocker. Exports from the 11 euro countries were 25% higher than those from the United States last year, and they were double those of Japan. Many, many years ago, there was a writer named Brian Connells who wrote a book called Watcher Along the Rhine because he lived in Germany, and he was a Reuters correspondent. And he listed the 25 leading German industrialists at that time in the late 1950s and said that of those, most of them were former card-carrying Nazis. And, of course, we knew that after World War II. But Ernst von Salomon was the one who wrote the book called Fragebogen, which is merely the German word for questionnaire. And because the Americans had turned over the process of denazification to the German authorities in 1947, think of that. Isn't that interesting? Ernst von Salomon wrote his book as a kind of a spoof against the ridiculous Fragebogen that they sent out to everybody, name your paternal grandfather, etc., trying to get everybody's lineage and who he was and where he came from, what he had done during the war to track down Nazis. Now, of course, most of them weren't tracked down, but after all, Eichmann was in Argentina, wasn't he? And he was a mass murderer, wasn't he? And the Mossad did stake out his house and kidnapped him and took him back to Israel. And he went to trial, didn't he? Because I spent the afternoon in the home of and out of the Yad Vashem and interviewed the gentleman who was one of the chief prosecuting attorneys against Eichmann. And he was a minister without portfolio in the Israeli government. They have known that for many, many years, Alfredo Stroessner, who was the dictator in Paraguay, was harboring Nazis, and you've all read books like The Boys from Brazil, and you know that Martin Bormann has been reported from Bolivia to Argentina, and many of you have known about San Carlos de Bariloche, which is a resort high in the foothills, like we call them, the Andes, the mountains, be almost like our Rocky Mountains down in the southern central province of Argentina, which is known as being a German colony, and there are huge estancias, as they call them there, that are owned by very, very wealthy Germans. When I first went to Buenos Aires, Argentina, I was shocked to see German bus lines, German magazines, German newspapers, and hear German being spoken on the streets, because a very large percentage of the Argentine population is German. A large percentage is Italian. Significant percentage is British. And those people are as fair-skinned as you and I. And only about 14% of the population equivalent to our black population is Indio in the nation of Argentina. They are not Mexican-looking people. They are basically European, second and third and fourth and fifth and so on, generation. I knew there would come a United States of Europe. I knew it would eventually include nations in Central Europe. Therefore, I could have said with great confidence, which I did, and when I wrote that article from Berlin that I began there on a United States of Europe, how soon, I was basing it upon the fact that during the entirety of the Cold War, I had known that the Warsaw Pact nations that were under the brutal domination of the Soviet Union would someday come out from behind the Iron Curtain and would unite with Western Europe and would become a part of the United States of Europe. Now, the NSA didn't know that. The FBI didn't know it. The CIA didn't know it. The Naval Intelligence or Army Intelligence or Air Force Intelligence agencies of this country didn't know it. If you all remember, when the Communist Union, when the Soviet Union imploded, it came as a shock to our own CIA. The CIA didn't know it. None of the presidents from the time of Eisenhower till Clinton knew anything about it until it happened. Reagan didn't know the force that his words would have, but Reagan, by saying, "Mr. Gorbachev, bring down this wall," did not bring down the wall. My wife can tell you that the instant I spotted Gorbachev on the first interview that he was conducted by, I think, the British press in London, I told her right then, that man is going to be instrumental in causing the Soviet Union to lift the Iron Curtain. And I knew. And I also knew and told you and told other people clear back in 1978 when Karol Wojtyla acceded to the Heilige Stuhl, or the so-called Holy See, that he was a Polish pope and that he would be instrumental in prying loose the iron communist grip from Poland. And that is exactly what happened. Remember that from 1945 until the 1960s, Germany went through what's called the Wirtschaftswunder. Now, the reason I brought up Brian Connells a moment ago was because he talked about the German political system, which is different from ours, which, where we're having all this scandal about foreign money and about fundraising. They allow large chunks of money called subventions to be given to the various political parties from the largest industrialists. And Connell was very worried because he said, so long as they're booming and so long as Germans are fat and happy and they've got jobs and as long as they're... You know, for a time in those years in the 1960s, there was zero unemployment in Germany. There was a fantastic, burst of industrial and economic strength in that nation for a long time. But along came the absorption of East Germany. And with it, the Bundesbank got hit a tremendous blow because they started subsidizing their poor eastern neighbors. And from that time to this, an awful lot of problems have come about in Germany, not the least of which was during their very wondrous resurgence. Millions of normal German citizens simply would not take the kind of menial jobs that foreigners would take. That's true in this country. You know that the entry-level workforce in this country are largely minorities. You go down to McDonald's, and you can prove that to yourself whenever you want to take time out to do it. And you know that. When you go to the hotels and the motels, you go to the restaurants, you get servant-class people in this country. If you look at people who are buying the little mom-and-pop grocery stores and little ramshackle motels that need to be refurbished, they are East Asian Indians, they are Orientals, they are minorities from other countries. Americans simply will not live that frugally. They will not live that close. And they will not scrimp and save and live in a tiny unit right in the little motel unit they're trying to rent out, but these other people will. That happened in Germany. And it began importing Turks and Italians and French, but especially Vietnamese and people from all over Asia and Southeast Asia and Indians and Pakistanis and other people. Well, when terrible economic malaise began gripping the East and therefore the entire nation after the attempt to absorb poor Eastern Europe, suddenly an awful lot of people found themselves out of a job. The younger people in Eastern Europe, in Eastern Germany, have been fair game for an awful lot of people who have pretty vivid memories of the good old days under Adolf Hitler. And there are many little fringe parties, among them the neo-Nazis, and not all called by names like that, that are very viable and very alive and well throughout Eastern Germany, and growing more and more and more in the Lands, L-A-N-D-S, that's their word for state, Lander or Land, like in Schleswig-Holstein and Lower Saxony, in Germany. And the increase of attacks and even murders against some of these people is just out of all proportion to any other kind of crime. They're throwing Turks out of fourth-story windows these days. They are beating and robbing and stabbing people, and instead of the Jews, they're calling them Ausländers. They're saying, Ausländer, aus! Ausländer, foreigner, get out of here. Now, Brian Connell warned that if any loss of that newfound prosperity should occur, that the direction of these political funds would reach very unsavory quarters. That is happening. It has happened. And right now, unemployment in Germany is at the rate of 20%. Things are happening in the streets of towns and cities all over Germany today that are reminding all kinds of people of exactly the way it was in 1933. And they are saying so, and they are writing about it. But let us not pay any attention to the headlines, because you know that what happens over there is never going to matter to us. And what happens in Jerusalem doesn't matter to us, does it? Well, yes, it does, doesn't it? We live in one global community, and that global community has shrunk by a tremendous amount in the last 40 years. So that one little event somewhere else affects events everywhere else in the entirety of the earth. Why did I go to Berlin so suddenly in 1989? Why was I so concerned about it? Because I knew that the United States of America is Manasseh, I knew that Britain is Ephraim, and I knew that the Germans are the ancient Assyrians, but the modern-day descendants of them. But even if I didn't know that, let's just pretend that the Germans are not the Assyrians, and we will be pretending. Let's pretend that the United States and northwestern Europe, especially the northern French and the people in Belgium, especially in Scandinavia and the lowlands of Holland and so on, are not the other tribes of Israel, like Britain and Ireland and Scotland and Wales, and like Norway and Denmark and Sweden and Finland and tiny Switzerland. And let's pretend that they're all a bunch of Gentiles. You can pretend that if you'd like, but you'd still have to ask this question. If Israel were to be attacked, and if Israel were to be occupied, and if Israel were to have its citizens deported in rail cars as slaves again, do you think that would involve the United States? Why? That'd be World War III, wouldn't it? And that could only happen during a World War III where we had what? Been either completely ineffective and unable to respond to do anything about it, or had lost whatever conflict has gotten going. Now let's go to the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation quite quickly. You might say a rather illogical place to go, but I remind you this, and as you're turning there, just say again that either there is a God or there isn't, and you can prove it or you can't. And either the Bible is His Word or it isn't. And if it isn't, what are we doing here? After these things, John said, I saw another angel come down from heaven having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory, and he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, is fallen. This was written in 92 A.D. When did Babylon fall? 539 B.C. Well, what in the world was this talking about then? Why would, if the one who was Jesus Christ, and your red-letter Bible has an awful lot of red letters, especially in the first three chapters of Revelation, gave John this prophecy, and if this is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which he gave to his servants to show his servants those things which must shortly come to pass on the earth, why would he be saying twice, Babylon is fallen, is fallen? Well, because this is metaphorical or prophetic or symbolic Babylon, it is not literal Babylon over near Baghdad or the capital of Iraq today. And it's talking about the second great collapse of something that is represented by Babylon the Great. And Babylon the Great is covered in the 17th chapter, which has to do with a coalition or with a union between a great false religious leader. And it is called Mystery, verse 5, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth, and the woman who is drunken with the blood of the saints rides over a beast, which is a coalition of 10 governments that is all covered in the 12th through the 14th verses. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdoms yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, that is one purpose or program, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast, and a power and strength of any kind of a country is its domestic product, its natural resources and raw materials, its labor force, I'll say it in a minute, and also, of course, its military power, its stockpiled weapons, and so on. Shall give their power and strength unto the beast, these shall make war with the Lamb. Now again, you, time and time again in the Bible, you come up against these absolutes. It's either absolutely right or it's absolutely wrong. And either there is a God and this is His Word, or it's all a sham and you shouldn't pay any attention to it. If there is a God and this is His Word, then it says that the time setting here is at the time of the second coming of Christ. And the time when these nations are at their absolute zenith of power is at the time when God has to intervene. And they turn their weapons upon Christ and try to fight what they see as being some kind of an invasion from outer space. Never in history has a world been more prepared for gigantic disasters or from invasions from outer space than our modern society. Book after book, movie after movie are absolutely fixated on gargantuan disasters. One of the latest ones they're just now hyping on television is going to show a wall of water look just exactly like one of the cartoons that Basil Wolverton put in a booklet about 40-some years ago, showing the destruction of New York by a gigantic tsunami about 245 feet high. And they're showing how they do that and the special effects and so on in some of the nighttime television that I've seen recently. I don't watch it, but I've seen the little vignettes where they show you an ad trying to get you to go to this latest gigantic disaster movie. As I was telling my wife last night, it seems like Hollywood only wants to produce movies where you get to see not just 10 or 20 people killed or shoot 'em outs or stabbed or garroted or thrown out a window, but you get to see millions dying now. And you get to see things like comets, and that's what this is about, smashing into the earth. Or you get to see things like hydrogen bombs exploding, or like gigantic plagues coming, and so on. So with that, plus all the movies that talk about extraterrestrial beings and ET and speculations about life in outer space and all of that, it helps explain how these people would do something like that. In the 18th chapter again, he says in verse 3, all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. That is an evil admixture of false doctrine and filth, which says it makes people spiritually drunk. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication. That is political concourse, or intercourse, if you choose. And the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Has there ever been such a thing as favoritism in trade? Now, we could go on that for the next hour or so, and we can also see now that there are documentaries way more than 50 years after the fact. One of them I saw a portion of just last night about this revelation of the tremendous hoards of Nazi gold in Swiss banks. Did any of you happen to see that? Then you saw the huge, big buckets of gold fillings being poured out. It was unbelievable. You saw pictures of the huge salt mine in Bavaria, where the greatest collection of any place, all the world's art galleries could not have actually held a candle to the collection of fine arts and the stuff that was in those salt mines way down, hidden away, where the Nazis spirited away tens of thousands of the finest old masters and the greatest paintings that all of those nations had ever produced. And here was gold and bullion and silver and jewelry. It showed a guy picking up jewelry. It was all tangled, met together. Hundreds and hundreds of pendants and watches and bracelets and things that once graced the neck of some 55, 60-year-old Jewish grandmother. Showed them pouring out teeth, and as I saw them cascading down in this ugly gold kind of a flow of gold teeth landing there, I wondered about the one I got right here and how it would hurt if they walked up to me and took it out, or what people would think that love me, if there are some people around, including my family, who do, about the way they would take it out of my head after I was dead. But every one of those gold teeth represented a lot of pain and drilling and a cavity and several visits to a dentist on the part of some poor Jewish person, and there were so many hundreds of thousands of them, and it even gave some of the documentation. Well, money, you know, the money trail and the incredible penchant for the Nazis to spirit away hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in foreign countries has been documented over and over and over again. And it's in Uruguay and Paraguay and in Argentina and in Spain and especially in Switzerland and in Bolivia and even here in the United States. Remember the man in Chicago some few years ago who was arrested, who had been an arch war criminal? Yes, there are those who have hidden out, who have changed their identities. Most of them would be in their late 70s and their 80s now. But there are still tens of thousands of them around, and they have grandkids. and they have espoused their doctrines, and they have talked about their feelings, and they have kept that culture alive. All right, well, it says it is going to be a great merchandising union. I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues, for her sins have reached unto heaven, and God has rewarded or remembered her iniquities. Reward her double unto her, double according to her works, in the cup in which she is filled, fill unto her double." I won't read all of this because it would take a lot of time, and I've got many scriptures I want to cover and very little time to do it in. But in verse 10, down to verse 9 and 10, it talks about the kings of the earth will lament when they see the smoke of her burning. It is a futuristic prophecy for the collapse of some great city, which is merely emblematic or symbolic of a great trading empire of some kind. And it's called Babylon, first of all, because of its false religion. Mystery. God is a mystery. You can't know God. Make funny signs, wear a dress, sprinkle salt, tinkle a bell, wave a feather, light a candle. God likes to smell a wax. And so you can't really understand much about God because he is an hypostasis, and they've got this mystery religion that they believe in. All right. Standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is your judgment come, and the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth their merchandise anymore." The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all fine wood and manner of vessels of ivory and vessels of the most precious woods and brass and iron and marble and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense, wine, oil, flour, wheat, beasts, sheep, horses, chariots, slaves. So, slaves? Well, no. Do you know what that really means in the original? When it says slaves and then souls of men means slaves. Slaves means bodies. That's what it says. A marketing of bodies. Now, I know, I won't go into this about body parts, and I know a little bit about fertilizer, and I know a little bit about gold teeth, but I also know about people that are actually sometimes put out of their misery a little ahead of time because of transplanting human organs. I also know about human organs, not only little fetuses, being used for research. I also remember Dr. Mengele, and I remember the boys from Brazil, and I remember that they finally decided that maybe that really was him that died. And the experiments that Nazi doctors performed on living patients in the camps like Majdanek and Birkenau and Buchenwald. "And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, saying, Alas, alas, that great city," again metaphorical now, for a great like trading empire, "was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour so great riches is come to naught. And every shipmaster and all the company in ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning." What? Where is Babylon? Where was ancient Babylon? Very far north from the Persian Gulf. As you go through the Shatt el-Arab and up the Euphrates River, you finally will come to Baghdad, and just barely near Baghdad, right outside of one of its suburbs, are the old ancient muddy ruins of Babylon. Ship captains and mariners don't see the smoke coming up from modern-day Baghdad. This is not talking about ancient Babylon. And there will be no reason for this prophecy to be here and for Jesus Christ to give this prophecy in vision to John, his disciple whom he loved, and to commission him to write it down so we would be reading it today when Babylon had fallen in 539 B.C. And this is written in 92 A.D., and it is for the time setting of that moment just before the second coming of Christ. "And they cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, Alas, alas, that great city wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour is she made desolate." It talks again about verse 21, and a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. And the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and trumpeters and so on shall be heard no more at all in thee. No craftsman of whatsoever craft shall be found any more in thee. And the sound of millstone, that's ancient grinding and all that type of thing, not modern methods of production, of course, really means factories, shall be heard no more in thee at all. And the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride, people going about their daily lives and having weddings and parties. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. I want you to turn quickly to the book of Hosea and the fifth chapter. There are many that I want to read to you, and I hope I have time, but let me remind you, first of all, if we were to say, let's deal with the prophetic date, which is unknown, of the second coming of Christ. And let's say we're going to deal with that as an event. And then we will simply come backward toward our time, and we will ask, what is the state, according to dozens of biblical prophecies? And we can forget for a moment, if you'd like, the identity of the United States and the British Commonwealth and Northwestern Europe. And we can just deal with Israel, because Israel is a nation inhabited by Jews. They are really Judah and Levi, and they are not Manasseh and Ephraim and Gad, Asher and Dan and Benjamin and so on. But many people think that that's all there is to Israel because they're utterly, abysmally ignorant of the Bible. Ignorant of the fact that there are four whole books that detail the separate national histories of Israel on the one hand and Judah on the other. Imagine the second coming of Christ and work backward from there, and every time you see Judah and or the house of Israel, and they are mentioned separately over and over again, when you see them mentioned in the Bible, Israel is in a condition of captivity, and they are scattered in nations all over. They are not right in one nation, but they have been deported to nations at all points of the compass. In the fifth chapter of Hosea, hear this, O you priests, and hearken, you house of Israel. The house of Israel in the Bible never means Judah or the Jews. It always means the ten tribes that were removed from 721 to 718 B.C. And give you ear, O house of the king, for judgment is toward you, because you've been a snare on Mizpah, that really meant a symbolic watchtower, and a net spread upon Tabor, that was in a lofty place, is all that meant. And the revolters, that is, those that are rebels against God, are profound to make slaughter. If you look at verse 6 of the next chapter, it says, I desired mercy and not sacrifice. And that's what it's referring to. God is saying, when it is not pleasing in His sight, that sacrificing animals to Him is just slaughter, though I have been a rebuker of them all. I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hid from me. You see, Hosea primarily concentrates on Ephraim. For now, O Ephraim, you commit whoredom, and Israel is defiled. They will not frame their doings to turn unto their God, for the spirit of whoredoms is in the midst of them, and they have not known the eternal. Biblical language for whoredom is having concourse with pagan nations and embracing their religions, but it's also depending upon them instead of depending upon God. The pride of Israel does testify to his face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity, and Judah shall also fall with them. Oh, well, then they're different. They're separate, aren't they? Ephraim is the major tribe, was to become a company of nations. Manasseh was the older brother. Ephraim was younger. But Manasseh was to become the greatest single nation the world has ever known, and they are brothers, the two children of Joseph. And the greatest single nation the world has ever known is the United States of America. And the greatest company or commonwealth of nations the world has ever seen is the British Empire. Judah shall also fall with them. They shall go with their flocks and their herds to seek the Eternal, but they shall not find Him. He has withdrawn Himself from them. They have dealt treacherously against the Eternal, for they have begotten strange children. Now shall a month devour them with their portions. And that seems to be significant with regard to the amount of time it's going to require. Blow ye the trumpet in Gibeah, and that was a city in the northern part of Israel, and the trumpet in Ramah, cry aloud at Beth-Aven, and that was instead is supposed to be the house of God, but it was the house of vanity instead. Instead of Beth-El, it was renamed by God prophetically because Beth-El means house of God, and Beth-Aven is the house of vanity, which was the place where they had their idols. After thee, O Benjamin, that had a border that was contiguous to Judah. Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be. The princes of Judah were like them that removed the bound, therefore I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he has willingly walked after the commandment. Therefore I will be unto the Ephraim as a moth, and unto the house of Judah as rottenness. Now notice, when Ephraim saw his sickness, isn't it interesting that Britain has been called the sick man of Europe? And Judah saw his wound. And that's interesting, too, because there is yet going to come another attack by combined Arab armies against modern-day Israel, and it may include chemical or biological weapons. Then went Ephraim to the Assyrian. King Jareb has never been found in the monuments or any of the records. It is unknown who he is. There was no record of him at all. Yet he could not heal you nor cure you of your wound. I find it fascinating, the pacts that have been made, and the treaties that have been written, and the dependency of the British as well as the United States. For many, many years we've been proclaiming that it is not fair for Germany to have that fantastic boom in its economic wealth and so on, and its standard of living, and the United States to go to bill for them to dwell under the nuclear umbrella and the protection of the United States. Now the Germans and other nations are saying that NATO should become a completely different organization, and that there should be, there already is the Franco-German defense arrangement, but that there should be a greater and a wider European defense arrangement. All those nations have been very happy to join NATO, because NATO has basically military overtones. And once the Cold War was over, there was no need for NATO, yet look at NATO expand. And even Clinton is hyping it and welcoming nations that creep further and further into Eastern Europe. And Russia says, look, we're getting very nervous with this. We're not really very excited about some of the Eastern European nations that used to be a Warsaw Pact country joining with NATO, which is called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Makes no sense at all. Now you see, some of the sickest of British industry, Rolls-Royce, proud name. Now talk about maybe Volkswagen and some of the German companies wanting to get together to take it over. And just the other day, Daimler-Benz, the Mercedes-Benz, merges with Chrysler. And Chrysler is a German name, of course, but not a German family. For I will be unto Ephraim as a lion, and as a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will tear and go away. I will take away, and none shall rescue him. I will go and return to my place till they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, during that captivity, they will seek me early. I won't read all the rest of this, but let's skip ahead in the seventh chapter a little bit, to verse 11. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. They call to Egypt, and they go to Assyria. When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. I will bring them down as the fowls of the heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation has heard. So there has got to be a witness and a warning, as their congregation shall have heard. Chapter 8, verse 1, set the trumpet to your mouth. He shall come as an eagle against the house of the Eternal. So here is God telling Hosea, his prophet, set the trumpet to your mouth. And as we've rehearsed time and again at the Feast of Trumpets, lift up your voice like a trumpet, cry aloud, spare not, etc., that the trumpet is an alarm of war and is an implement used by a watchman to alert people to an impending attack. He, that is this attacking force, it is Assyria, shall come as an eagle against the house of the Eternal, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Israel shall cry unto me, my God, we know thee. That's what they say. They are God's people. We are God's people. We have a form of religion. Israel has cast off the thing that is good. The enemy shall pursue, and they have set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes, and I knew it not, of their silver and their gold, and they made them idols that they may be cut off. Your calf, O Samaria, and Samaria was the capital of the northern ten tribes, has cast thee off, because that is false religion, it is sun worship, it is absolutely pagan. In verse 7, you have heard this scripture all your life, they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. It hath no stalk, the bud shall yield no meal, if so be it yield, the stranger shall swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up, now shall they be among the Gentiles as a vessel wherein there is no pleasure. For they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim has hired lovers. That's pacts, and of course foreign aid, and cooperation with foreign governments. Yea, though they have hired among the nations, now will I gather them, and they shall sorrow a little, or for a little while, it really should say, for the burden of the king of princes. Because Ephraim has made many altars to sin, altars shall be unto him to sin. Chapter 9 and verse 7 is very interesting. The days of visitation are come, the days of recompense are come, Israel shall know it. The prophet is a fool. That's established religion, the prophets of Israel. They're fools. The prophet is a fool, the spiritual man is mad for the multitude of thine iniquity and the great hatred. The watchman of Ephraim was with my God, but the prophet is a snare of a fowler in all his ways and hatred in the house of his God. Established prophets, established churches, established religions deal with hatred, and they're like a snare, like a trap. But the watchman of Ephraim was with my God. If you were to ask, what is the condition of Israel every single time you see the second coming of Christ? Let's turn to the 10th chapter of the book of Isaiah right quickly. And verse 5, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against an hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take spoil and to take the prey. Remember that the northern armies of Assyria came into Israel in 721 to 718, you count this way, B.C. In three successive waves of invading forces, removed every last citizen out of those houses. The houses were not destroyed. The cities were left intact. And instead, they, as a sister state with Babylon, deported from some of their areas a dark, swarthy people that had been emigrating in from the south. And they became known as Sumerians, and that's why you see the racism between Jews and Samaritans that were extant in the land during the time of Jesus Christ. And those Samaritans were brought in and replaced in the cities that were vacated by the deported Israelites, who were then taken up into the land between the Black and the Caspian Sea. The sister state of Babylon began to grow into the ascendancy, and Assyria began to wane and disappeared. It never again attacked into Israel. It never attacked Judah. It was not even a significant nation, didn't even for all purposes exist anymore by the time of the captivity of the Jews in about 586. Instead, from 721 earlier, many hundreds of years, generations earlier, of those people had begun to migrate. Dan, as you know, did what a lot of people do when they come to a place and old grandpa decides to name it after him. And a lot of major rivers and headlands and prominences and maybe bays and estuaries and confluences of rivers and valleys and so on are named after people, aren't they? Well, it was a city in northern Israel many, many years ago when the Israelites first began to inherit the land called Lachish. It was a walled city, and the tribe of Dan was given that part of the land. Remember that the Bible says that half tribe of Dan abode in ships. Half of them were seafaring, and half of them lived on the land. They attacked Lachish, they broke down the walls, and they occupied Lachish, and they changed its name to Dan. And from that time on, you read in the Bible, from Dan to Beersheba. And Beersheba is the southern reaches of the nation, and Dan the northern. Dan always left his name wherever he went, which is why the very earliest settlers in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales were called the Tuatha, meaning tribe in an ancient tongue, De Danann, or the Danish, or Danites. Who are the Danes? Why is that called Denmark here when it's called Danmark there, and it merely means the mark of Dan? Because they are the people of Dan. When you go from the Crimea, and who were the Gimri, or the Kimri, or the Kimmerians? They were the people who were the Bechumri, which was a corruption of Omri, the major trading king that traded such to great extent with Assyria, and was very greatly revered by them, which was one of the kings of northern Israel. Those people were called different names by their enemies, or by people through whom they migrated. And the names of all of these old states that have disappeared long since are not because the people are no longer here or their modern descendants, but because the names have simply lapsed into history. Who are the Goths? Nobody knows. The Ostrogoths, the Vandals, the Heruli. Who are the Visigoths? Nobody knows. Who were the Thracians? There's a major article right now in Time magazine showing beautiful jewelry and so on by people of Thrace. They disappeared. Well, that's because other nations simply called people by the names that they attached to them, which is why a Teut, which is a spear, became a Teuton or a spear thrower, which is why it is called to this day Deutschland, which is the name of Germany. And that merely was the name that the Romans attached to people that lived above the northern leans of Rome, which was their outward line of defense. So these people got other names attached to them. When Dan began to migrate along that area, not only was the little peninsula called the Crimea or the Gimmery, the areas of the Cimmerians or the Gimmerines, the Crimean Peninsula, but right there was the Dnieper River and the Dnieper and the Dniester River, and then you come to the Don River, and then the Udon River, and then here's the Danube. And Danube is Latin for River of Dan. Uba, meaning water or river, and Dan, meaning the River of Dan. Those people went into Europe and northwestern Europe. I want to get to one real quickly here that would be something that is absolutely inescapable. In the 11th chapter, I don't have time for all of the 10th and some of the 14th I want to give you here, but let's go to the 11th chapter right quickly. It gives you the time setting, the second coming of Christ. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 8 talks about conditions to become extant during the millennium. And then chapter 11, and beginning in verse 10, in that day shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, to it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. Now this is talking about the second coming of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom of God on the earth. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people which shall be left from Assyria and Egypt and Paphos, which is a northern province of Egypt, like in today's Sudan, from Cush and Elam, and Cush may mean India, and from Shinar, which is right now the plain where Aqaba is, and from Hamath, or actually the Iraqis, the land of Shinar is where Baghdad is, I should say, and from the islands or the coastlands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah. Notice how they're listed separately. The outcasts of Israel and the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. There's a very great deal there as to why the British have felt the way they do about the Jews over the years. Ephraim shall not envy Judah. The anti-Semitism will disappear. And Judah shall not vex Ephraim. But they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them of the east together. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab. And Edom is Turkey. And the book of Obadiah is a prophecy that I've gone through to show how that's going to happen. And the Moabites are the people probably of Transjordan, primarily the nation of Jordan and Iraq. And the children of Ammon, and Ammon is the capital of Jordan, shall obey them. And the Eternal shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river, and shall smite it in the seven streams, and make men go over dry shod. And there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. They're going to come from that land. Where is that land? Is that modern-day Iraq, one province right next to Kurdistan, where there are people who are Arabic, who are dark and swarthy, that still have the name Assyria? Or are they the modern descendants of those people? Notice in the 14th chapter and verse 25, I'll read up to it while you're turning there. The Eternal of Hosts has sworn, saying, surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass, and as I have purposed, so shall it stand, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains will I tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. That never happened in all of history. Assyria was successful. They invaded, they took Israel captive, they went back to their land, they were basically overwhelmed and subjugated by the rising power of Babylon. They began to drift across the area, as I said, of the Crimea and along the various river valleys. They followed the Don and the Danube and so on to its sources, and that's where those same people basically are today. Now, time out. forget for a moment, as I said earlier, the national identities, forget the identity, so-called movement. People are very suspicious about that. We have nothing to do with that. It is no kind of a cloak for racism or anything of the kind. We are not white supremacists because we believe this, because we know what God is going to send upon the United States and the British Commonwealth of Nations. Forget the fact that the original 13 colonies and that the United States is Manasseh. We know it's a melting pot today. But the original peoples, by the time of the Louisiana Purchase and the westward movement of the United States, were Manassites. And forget that Britain is Ephraim and Germany is Assyria. Doesn't matter. Just look at the geopolitical map of today and ask yourself that when we see the deportation that the Bible does say, using Judah, if you think Israel is Jew, that's fine. But Judah is Jew, that's for sure. And you see that they're going to be in a state of captivity. They're going to be deported. They're going to be spread to the four winds, the four points of the compass. And they will be in that condition at the time of the second coming of Christ. Christ's Olivet prophecy says, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive. He is coming to save mankind from literally exterminating himself and cutting short the war that is going to get started just before it would mean the extermination of all of human life. And what does he do? He sends his heavenly signs to seal the 144,000 and the great innumerable multitude. And shortly thereafter, the wrath of God is poured out through the seven trumpet plagues and the seven last plagues. And then Christ stands on the earth. And what is the first thing he's going to do? You just read it. Regather Israel from Assyria, Patros, Cush, Shinar, the coastlands of the sea, and bring them back into the land of Palestine. If you think it means Judah, then you can also put this in your mind and never forget it, that the United States would be instantly and deeply involved in any major war that would break out in the Middle East that would mean the deportation of Jews. I'm going to add a new feature to World Watch. I'm going to add just a real series of dozens of headlines. And every single time you read it, you will be able to read headlines from all over the world by the dozen that will tell you a very great deal of what is going on. But with the appointment of this new super powerful Alan Greenspan, except he's got a German name, over the European Central Bank, and the launching of the Euro, and the coming together of these 11 nations, it'll eventually fulfill the prophecy of the 10 in Europe. I say that we still need to sit up and watch.